Good, that I'm so well informed. So, very welcome to this event in our lecture series at the Center for Research into Freemason Fraternalism. And this autumn term, we have lectures on Freemason Fraternalism in the Middle East. And the purpose of the center is to interact with the wider community and inside the university on the kind of research we are doing. I'm very happy to welcome a very distinguished speaker today. It's Isaac Lubelski, and just to comment upon the topic of his lecture, the star in the east, is of course a good topic when we have such a dark evening in Sheffield, and it has even been snowing up in the Peak District outside Sheffield. So the star in the east is of course a nice image to think about. Isaac Lubelski wrote his dissertation in the School of History at Tel Aviv University, and he was dealing in his thesis with the history of the Theosophical Society, from which is a Western movement, and contributed to the formation of what today is called the New Age thought. And in a sense, Isaac is working further on these topics. Is lecturing at three universities, as he told me before, and so we must be very, very busy. And we are very happy to welcome him here. So his paper is not directly related to Freemasonry especially, but of course the star in the east is a big symbol in the Masonic world, mm-hmm. and in some rituals. So I very much look forward to your lecture, Isaac. The Star of the East, Occultist Perceptions of the Mystical Orient. So the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes. So good afternoon, everyone. Actually, it's good evening already. Thank you for attending this lecture, and a special thank you to Dr. Onifors and Ms. Dorothea Zoma, who have invited me to Sheffield, which so far seems to be a lovely place. I hope you excuse me if I use my paper here, because my English is kind of okay, but I think I better be reading directly out of my paper. The image of the mystical Orient, whether the near, the middle, or the Far East, served as a continuous source of attraction and inspiration for a vast number of European prophets and occultists in recent centuries. Naturally, this image derives partly from the identification of the East as a sacred region that gave birth to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Nonetheless, some of the mystical prestige of the East originates from its identification as the geographical source of ancient magic and of the occult. European alchemists and occultists used to consider Egypt and Chaldea as the birthplace of the occult arts, at least until late 19th century. For some of them, India replaced Egypt's place as the oriental birthplace of magic due to the views published and propagated by the Theosophists since 1877. Tibet joined the competition more or less in the same time, again thanks to the Theosophist Madame Blavatsky, alongside imaginary other oriental places such as Shangri-La and its like. Blavatsky had an important role in branding another modern concept in regard to the roots of magic and occultism, when claiming that the real birthplace of these ancient arts was no other than the lost continent of Atlantis. However, since this seminar and lecture deal with the Orient, and particularly with the Middle East, let us ignore Atlantis for the time being. This way or the other, the image of the mystical Orient seems to be an essential part of many early modern and modern European occultist doctrines. Moreover, it is vividly present in some of the founding myths of several major occultist movements, either in a plain geographical form or in a more spiritual stance. It seems that almost any major occultist with a serious magical pretension had to prove a certain relation to the East. The East, in this sense, became something grander than just a mere geographical direction, neither just the cradle of the endlessly rebirthing sun. It became a concept, crucially needed in order to gain authority and legitimacy. In other words, since the Renaissance time, no magic was real unless it was deeply rooted in the Orient. This European comprehension of the East may be sensed in non-occultist arenas as well. For example, think of the two major others in European history, the Jews and the Gypsies. Both originated in the Orient, the Jews in Judea or Palestine, and the Gypsies in India, but still the term Gypsy reflects etymologically on Egypt. Both immigrated to the Occident, both were regarded as possessing magical or occultist power, Jewish Kabbalah, for example, or Gypsy palm reading. Both were regarded more feminine and thus perhaps with a better accessibility to magic in comparison to the presumed masculinity of the Europeans, who emphasized their rationalism and perhaps thus their incompetence in regard to genuine magic. This lecture we follow the steps of two crucial Oriental myths, the German myth of Christian Rosenkreuz, the legendary founder of the Order of Rosicrucians, who was supposedly initiated in Fez, Morocco, and the Oriental myth that was nurtured by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society, who was again supposedly initiated in Tibet. I will compare the two cases, examine the role of the mystical East in both, and sketch some of the common Oriental motifs that are widely used by many other influential occultist and esoteric orders. Allow me to briefly reflect on the early history of Theosophy before comparing it with Rosicrucianism. In the year 1875, a somewhat odd group of people gathered in New York City in the residence of two close friends, the Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, born in 1832, died in 1907, and the famous spiritualist Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. This gathering marked the foundation of the Theosophical Society, which later expanded to much larger dimensions and is considered today by many as the progenitor of the contemporary New Age movement. The two chums, as they nicknamed each other, met several months earlier. On their first encounter, Olcott was struck by Blavatsky's piercing gaze and noticed that she was a compulsive eater and smoker. In his journal, he described their first encounter, and I quote, "I said, 'Permettez-moi, madame,' and gave her a light for her cigarette. Our acquaintance began in smoke, but it stirred up a great and permanent fire." End of quote. Indeed so. Blavatsky was born in 1831. Her father, the Baron von Hahn, was an army officer of German-Russian origin, a member of the minor aristocracy which constituted the upper echelons of the Tsar's officer's class. Blavatsky's mother came from the higher aristocracy, the Dolgorukiy family. She died in 1842 when Blavatsky was 11 years old. The young Helena passed her adolescence between the house of her maternal grandparents and the army bases in various parts of the Tsarist Empire where her father was stationed. Blavatsky's widowed father, the Baron von Hahn, was presumably anxious to find her a suitable match. In 1848, he married her to the 40-year-old Nikifor Blavatsky, the deputy military governor of Yerevan in Armenia. The age gap between them might explain why after only 3 months, Blavatsky ran away from her husband to Constantinople and began a new phase in her life. Thereafter, according to her account, she wandered for years before arriving in America. Her travel tales covering several continents cannot all be verified. She claimed that she was guided by her longing for the ancient esoteric lore which had been preserved in countries with a rich magical tradition. Egypt, which existing esoteric tradition serves as the oldest source of arcane knowledge, was her first major stop. But her most significant sojourn was in Tibet, where she claimed to have spent more than 7 years, during which time she was instructed by spiritual teachers whom she called Mahatmas, or masters. They taught her their esoteric secrets and brought her to the highest level of initiation accessible to a mortal being. Information from other sources conflicts with some of Blavatsky's stories. For example, Olcott, her partner, stated that after her death, he was told that prior to coming to America, Blavatsky had been a professional pianist and traveled about Russia and Italy under the name Madame Laura. Other testimonies suggest that during her period, the period when she was supposedly in Tibet, she was seen in other places. These contradictions are not important in themselves, though they undermine Blavatsky's credibility. However, her own writings contain material much more dubious than the questionable veracity of her various travel stories. According to Blavatsky, the masters who mentored her in Tibet and kept in touch with her throughout her life were human beings who had succeeded in evolving to a higher level of existence than that of ordinary mortals. They were members of a body called the Great Brotherhood, consisting of a succession of spiritual teachers who had influenced human history. The members of the Great Brotherhood were always engaged in a struggle against the forces of darkness, whom Blavatsky called the Brothers of the Shadow, who sought to hold back humanity's development. From time to time, these masters approached evolving individuals who aspired to be their apprentices during their spiritual development. Such a disciple was called a chela. As the chela advanced, he became an adept, able to apply his acquired magical knowledge to himself and his surroundings. Next came the highest stage of development, when the adept became an initiate. Such a person was freed from the constraints of time, and his consciousness contained the past, present, and future. Blavatsky especially venerated two particular members of the Tibetan Great Brotherhood, the master Kuthumi, who in one of his renowned incarnations was named Pythagoras, and the master Moya. These two masters cultivated and initiated Blavatsky in Tibet, instructed her to create a theosophical society, and remained in contact with her successors after her death. Communication with those masters took two forms. The first was by means of visions, which was rare and accessible only to sufficiently advanced theosophists. The second, a more common method, entailed more earthly means. The messages from the masters arrived in the form of written and sealed messages, which miraculously dropped from the ceiling or appeared out of nowhere. Many members of the society were granted such marvelous missives. Actual visions were granted to very few other than Blavatsky. According to Blavatsky, it was the duty of the members of the Great Brotherhood to watch over the human race and guide its spiritual development. She claimed that they intensified their efforts in the final quarter of every century, when one of them would appear to communicate esoteric lore to humanity. This idea was developed further by Blavatsky's successor, Mrs. Annie Besant, who called this master a world teacher, identified him with the Hindu term Bodhisattva, and maintained that her young Hindu protege, Jiddu Krishnamurti, was the world teacher of our time. Indeed, she named the order she founded for him the OSE, the Order of the Star in the East, and henceforth the title of this lecture. Blavatsky located her masters in the mountains of Tibet, probably chosen for two reasons. One, that mountains are generally thought of as sacred, always the home of the gods. Two, Tibet's geographic and cultural isolation at that time made it a suitable venue for stories of the mystical sort. For these reasons, Tibet and her version of Buddhism have been favorites of the Western imagination for the past 200 years. Although during the 19th century a good number of Western adventurers, military men, and mystics attempted to reach Tibet, few actually succeeded. Regular contact with Tibet began only in 1904, when the British military mission arrived in Lhasa. It was led by the explorer and mystic Francis Younghusband, who was born in India and who forced the current Dalai Lama to approve a trade agreement with Britain. The Tibetan mystique grew in the West to an exceptional degree as the country became more accessible. Today, this mystique seems to be at its height, with the widespread Western support for the Tibetan national struggle and the popularity of Tibetan Buddhism, as shown in a number of films and the spread of religious material. It seems that Blavatsky contributed to the glorification of Tibet's image in the world by locating her masters on the roof of the world and linking her spiritual movement to the Himalayas. She claimed that it was the masters who instructed her to go to America and meet Olcott, quote, whose karma linked him to her as the co-agent to set this social wave in motion, end quote. The name of the new Theosophical Society was decided at the third meeting held by the small membership on September the 18th, 1875. Various suggestions were declined, among them the Hermetic Society, the Rosicrucian Society, and the Egyptological Society. The Theosophical Society declared its aims as follows. 1. The study of occult science. 2. The formation of a nucleus of universal brotherhood. 3. The revival of Oriental literature and philosophy. After several frustrating years, the young and small Theosophical Society gradually began to expand. The significant factor contributing to the relative success of the society was Blavatsky's impressive writing ability. Though self-taught, she was evidently familiar with the academic publications of the new science of comparative religion. This familiarity, as well as a long interest in the occult, led her to conclude that theosophy, like any new religion, needed a broad theological basis to allow for future interpretation and give it a long-term vitality. From this insight was born Isis Unveiled, published in 1877, a massive 1,200-page work in two volumes, which took Blavatsky 6 months' labor to produce. She claimed that large parts of it were supernaturally dictated to her by the masters, making her the transmitter of the revealed knowledge rather than its author. Her primary motive in writing the book was to answer two questions which had preoccupied her when she was traveling in the East. Who and what was the deity and where he dwelt, and was there any evidence of the immortality of the human soul? The book surveyed the histories of various religions in antiquity and attempted to trace the roots of the magical arts in biblical, Hindu, Vedic, and Hermetic literature. The survey, which concluded that India was the cradle of arcane lore, purported to use the methodology of comparative research. The various subjects were approached through questions concerning the mysterious phenomena in our world, though without offering substantial answers. Blavatsky contented herself with describing the phenomena and left their solutions to her readers' imagination. Strangely, the operation of the Theosophical Society declined after the publication of Isis Unveiled. Few people joined during this period, the most prominent of them being Thomas Alva Edison, who sent Olcott his membership forms on April 4, 1878. Blavatsky and Olcott were dissatisfied with the society's slow progress. Most esoteric movements devoted to the search for gnosis are selective and elitist, but not the theosophists, who definitely hankered for the widest publicity. The slowness of the process seems to the movement's leaders to reflect the materialistic degeneration of American society. Blavatsky maintained that a vast struggle between spirituality and materialism was taking place in a lifetime, and suggested that the success of materialistic approach resulted from the French Revolution and the decline of the church. American materialism was impeding the reception of the Theosophist message and led Blavatsky and Olcott to the conclusion that they ought to propagate the tenets of the new faith in a different geographical setting, one less tainted with materialism. And since the ideological transition Blavatsky underwent at that time led her, as we have seen, to conclude that India was the cradle of esoteric wisdom, she naturally looked for India as the lodestone of her dreams and plans. However, in the 1870s, a journey to India entailed considerable financial and physical efforts. Moreover, it was an unknown land for Blavatsky and Olcott, neither of whom was young. However, the two chums underwent the trouble and eventually sailed to India in 1879, where their society was to play a crucial role in the story of the then-awakening nationalist Indian movement. The second half of 1878 looked more promising than the first, when Blavatsky and Olcott were heartened by the news from London, where on June the 27th, the British Theosophical Society was formally founded, the first branch of the society outside the United States. The birth of the British Society was due to Olcott's initiative in sending to London the treasurer of the New York Society, one John Storer Cobb. Cobb gathered a number of British individuals who were excited by the theosophical ideas. They elected as the first president Charles Carlton Massey. Later, in 1884, under the presidency of Anna Kingsford, the British branch changed its title to the London Lodge of the Theosophical Society, and so it remains to this day. Blavatsky and Olcott visited the London Lodge in 1879 on their way to India, and were indeed impressed by the enthusiasm of their local English followers. In India, the two founders of the Theosophical Society eventually settled down in Adyar, a poor suburb of the southern town of Madras, Chennai today, where the world headquarters of the Theosophical Society still operates today. They traveled all over India, speaking to large crowds, propagating their belief in the superiority of the ancient Hindu culture over the declining Western culture, and calling for a revival of that ancient culture, a renaissance that will reawake India and bring it back to where it belongs, among the leading nations of the world. The call for a spiritual Indian renaissance was motivated by their belief in a radical global spiritual revolution that would take place as its immediate result. Given the Theosophist's original interest in Hermetic philosophy, Kabbalah, and Western occult sciences, they saw the Hindu text as cryptic and laden with hidden significance, to be viewed in a Gnostic light and interpreted by means of Gnostic terms. Such was their interpretation to various Hindu scriptures, whom they comprehended as belonging to the same corpus of writing that included the Corpus Hermeticum, for example, or Giordano Bruno's writings. In other words, the Theosophist was certain that the same esoteric doctrine stood behind the Hindu, the Egyptian, and the Western esoteric writings. This notion had its roots in the 18th and 19th century Orientalist research, which was then dominated by what is nowadays regarded as the Aryan myth, the belief in the mutual source of both Hindus and Europeans. This myth was first born in the mind of Sir William Jones, who studied Sanskrit in Calcutta in the 1780s, and became the first to note the affinity between the Sanskrit and Greek and Latin. That affinity led him to phrase a hypothesis according to which the ancestors of both Hindus and modern Europeans were related to the same ancient Aryan nation, which in prehistory existed, according to Jones, in Iran. Some of its people had traveled to the west and conquered Europe, while others headed to the east and conquered India. Both Eastern and Western Aryans preserved the mutual history by means of language. Thus, language was the principal tool to follow the steps and the only viable evidence to their common origin. Accordingly, Blavatsky claimed that it was the same Aryan esoteric wisdom that is to be studied in India and Europe alike. Olcott and Blavatsky's attraction was not limited to Hinduism. In the year 1880, they first went to Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and stayed there for 2 months, during which Olcott was captivated by the local Sinhalese Buddhism and adopted a new custom. Thereafter, he favored the garb of a Buddhist priest. It was on this visit that Olcott and Blavatsky publicly converted to Buddhism, probably the first Westerners to do so, long before Mr. Richard Gere and his likes. In the year 1885, Blavatsky and Olcott's reputation was struck by the publishing of the critical Hodgson Report. Richard Hodgson was a young scholar who in 1884 was appointed by the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, to go to Adyar, India, and inspect Blavatsky's presumed miracles and magical pretensions. He spent there a few months and was eventually led to believe that Blavatsky was a sophisticated fraud. Olcott could not stand the shame, and Blavatsky had to leave for Europe. She finally came to London in 1889, where she evoked a considerable wave of interest. In London, she wrote a few more books, the most well-known being The Secret Doctrine. In addition to that, she published a periodical entitled Lucifer, and finally left this world for good in 1891. The story of her successors is no less fascinating. However, due to time limits, I will stop here and return later to Blavatsky. There is no doubt that Blavatsky was influenced by the Freemasons, if only by their terminology, for example, the terms masters or lodges. Moreover, the Masons were the first to operate an international network of lodges all loyal to the Marvel movement, a model which the Theosophists emulated. Another interesting point in this connection is the exclusion of women, which still exists in some of the orders of the Freemasons. Blavatsky was displeased by this patriarchal attitude. Besant, her successor, fought against it when she joined in 1902 the Core Masonry, an alternative order of Freemasons unrecognized by the official orders, which accepted women members. However, it seems to me that another order, that of the Rosicrucians, had influenced Blavatsky no less than Freemasonry. The myth of the Rosicrucian fraternity flourished in Europe throughout the 17th century. Its origins went back to the medieval myth of the Templars, revived by 3 pamphlets published in the German city of Kassel between 1614 and 1616, which became known as the Rosicrucian Manifestos. Their protagonist was the priest, Christian Rosenkreuz, who announced the founding of an order or fraternity and invited new members to join. The first 2 pamphlets aroused interest, which intensified in 1616 with the publication of the third, entitled The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz. It is quite obvious that at least the 3rd pamphlet was a hoax made by one Johann Valentin Andrea, born in 1586, died in 1654. The pamphlets, which were distributed all over Europe, created a severe turmoil when many people were suspected as members of the Rosicrucian fraternity, which ironically probably never existed. The tenets of the order, which described itself as a secret fraternity of enlightened scholars, influenced 19th century writers, among them Blavatsky. For example, the 1st pamphlet, entitled Fama Fraternitatis, contained biographical information about the founder, C.R., the initials of Christian Rosenkreuz. Born to a noble but poor family, he was educated in a monastery, where he learned Greek and Latin. Later he traveled to the Orient, spent 2 years in Fez, Morocco, where he was taught by local sages and later founded his fraternity. The tenets of the fraternity were as follows. 1. The members had to practice charity and heal the sick. 2. The members had to keep secret their affiliation with the fraternity and to observe the local customs where they lived. 3. The fraternity would hold annual meetings in specified places. 4. Each member would choose a successor to follow him after his death. 5. The initials CR were the seal and symbol of the fraternity. 6. The fraternity would remain secret for 100 years. The main idea in this and the other pamphlets was that the mission of the fraternity was to do good by studying wisdom and keeping the secret. This idea of a kind of a shadow government operating in various countries and subject to a central body is quite similar to Blavatsky's Great Brotherhood. It seems that Blavatsky did not know the pamphlets at first hand, otherwise she would probably have quoted them in her writings, which she didn't. But the impact of the pamphlets lingered in Europe long after the publication. The story of the Rosicrucian fraternity inspired later writers such as Edward Bulwer Lytton, in whose 1842 novel Zanoni, the mid-19th century English readers were to follow the story of the protagonist Zanoni, an immortal Chaldean who in the beginning of the novel just returned from India. Blavatsky knew well Bulwer Lytton's books on the occult. Certainly, reading the Fama recalls some marked similarities with Blavatsky's story, both the real and the imaginary elements. She too, like Rosencrantz, was of an aristocratic background, claimed to know Latin and Greek, and studied occult lore in an exotic location. Whereas Rosencrantz was content with Morocco, which was regarded by 16th and 17th century Europeans as sufficiently remote, Blavatsky had to go to the Far East and study in distant Tibet. Both created their fraternities after their studies and dedicated themselves to good works. Moreover, one of the usages adopted by the Theosophists, the use of initials instead of whole names, for example, Blavatsky was always called HPB, was already found in the pamphlets of the Rosencrantz fraternity. Likewise, the use of the term fraternity stands out both with regard to the Great Brotherhood and to the second aim of the Theosophical Society, which was, as we have seen, the formation of a nucleus of universal brotherhood. From the 17th century on, the myth of the Rosicrucian fraternity inspired many esoteric movements which claimed to derive from the original Rosencrantz order. Among them was the Theosophical Order, the Temple of the Rosicross, founded in London in 1912. Yet, while the members of the Rosencrantz fraternity were committed to total secrecy, this was not necessarily part of the Theosophical agenda, except perhaps for its esoteric section, a secretive elite group formed in London by Blavatsky shortly before her death. The attraction to the East can be found with other influential occultists, such as with Cagliostro, who won a reputation as a healer and alchemist in the 1770s and the 1780s, after his return to Europe from traveling in the Middle East. He too, like Christian Rosencrantz, spent a long period in the Arab countries, where he claimed to have acquired his knowledge of the occult. He treated many people of all walks of life and gained a following that served as the basis for the formation of a new Freemason movement led by him, called the Egyptian Rite of Freemasonry. Unlike the original Freemasons, it accepted women and Jews. Cagliostro set up lodges of his order all over Europe, but while he was popular among seekers of the occult, political circles viewed him with suspicion. In reality, there was nothing Egyptian in the rites of his order, which mainly claimed to communicate with the seven angels of the apocalypse, whom Cagliostro used to contact through a mediator, usually a boy or a girl, who went into a trance and answered his questions on behalf of the angels. Toward the end of his life, he attracted the attention of the Catholic Church, was accused of heresy, and won the dubious reputation as the last person to be burned at the stake by the Roman Inquisition. Cagliostro is remembered as a charlatan and mountebank, but his story is a good example of the mysterious Manus, commanding occult powers, a cosmopolitan figure hobnobbing with the higher society in various countries. The charm of this image kindled the imagination of many 19th century Europeans and inspired Blavatsky, whose own image contained similar elements. I could go on and mention many other persons or movements who claimed that their inspiration or authority were Oriental. Perhaps the popularity of the Eastern motif in pre-20th century occultism paved the way for the expansion of the real Oriental spiritual practices and ideologies in our time. I do not wish to be cynical, but let us think. With practices such as shiatsu and acupuncture, alongside Japanese and Chinese martial arts, accompanied by Indian yoga and Ayurveda, would all of these be as popular as they are if they would have originated, let's say, in Belgium or perhaps in Ireland? I seriously doubt that. The power the Orient still has over our imagination is visible to all eyes. The occultists we deal with in our research have an important role in making the East so powerful for us. I hope that this point seems interesting enough for you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you look into the local news here in Sheffield, Yorkshire is always the center of the world. So they don't need to look into the East. It's like
Rotherham is in the East.
Rotherham is in the East. Right. Yeah. That's it. I was very fascinated by your talk, and especially when thinking about the larger topic of the dynamics of the theosophical movement, and also then referring back to the Rosicrucians as a fraternal organization, that you at that time in history have this group of people that actually are realizing such an endeavor on a kind of global scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite fascinating, which I think is several factors that are working together here.
Mm-hmm.
in that. Would you call the theosophical movement in its first stage actually acting as a fraternal organization, or would they actively copy the organizational patterns of it, or is it what are your thoughts about the inner dynamics that brought these people together?
Mm-hmm.
in the first period of its existence?
Well, it depends on which period you refer to, because in the beginning you're talking about a very small number of people.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah.
At its height, the Theosophical Society had about 40,000 members.
Yes.
That was in 1929. And it was a direct result of the Krishnamurti cult. I didn't want to roll into this because of time limits, but Krishnamurti was a Hindu boy who was he was discovered, so to speak, by Annie Besant's closest friend, one Charles Webster Ledbetter, who was Blavatsky's successor in everything that has to do with clairvoyance and occultism. And he discovered that boy in Adyar on the beach while the boy was bathing in the ocean, and decided that he was the actual avatar of both Krishna and Jesus Christ. And Annie Besant put most of her energy in, let's say, from 1910 until 1929 to the promotion of Krishnamurti's cult. The order she founded for him was open for anyone, not just TS members, Theosophical Society members, but still many people joined the Theosophical Society due to this cult. They were impressed with the young Hindu and were sure that something real was going on, until he denounced the society in 1930. But certainly in the beginning, during Blavatsky's time, the society was a fraternity in many ways. And also later on, when she was in London, as I've mentioned, she founded an elite group called the Esoteric Section, the ES, which was definitely acting as a secret fraternity, and it had many famous members such as the poet Yeats and Annie Besant herself. So it depends on which circle you refer to, whether the secretive smaller circle or the general circle of disciples worldwide.
Right, thank you so much. Well, the floor is open for questions.
What was his denunciation? What did he claim? Or what
Krishnamurti?
Yeah.
Well, in order to answer a full question, I'll have to describe the cult that was developed around this person for just a few seconds, okay? The Theosophists believe that we are living in a time of a change, that a new sub-race has been, they believed that in the beginning of the 20th century, that the new sub-race, the last sub-race of the Aryan race, was being formed in America. And they believe that the members of the Great Brotherhood, of the Mahatmas, sent a member of the Brotherhood to teach the sons and daughters of this new race its spiritual way, so to speak. And this person who the Theosophists called a world teacher, that identified Krishnamurti as the new world teacher and were expecting the awakening of this long soul of the world teacher in his earthly body. And since in 1924, Krishnamurti had gone through a series of trances and began himself, I think, to feel that he is indeed the new world teacher. It took him some years, this is my guess, to rethink this position that was in a way impeded on him by the Theosophists. He was, so to speak, taken as a captive when he was about 12 years old, 13 years old in India. His father agreed to him being taken to England, but Krishnamurti didn't have any say in this. And by the time he had grown up and became a man, I think that he was just being rebellious in a way against the people who have forced him to disconnect from his own culture. He never saw his father again, in this sense. His the new religion, so to speak, that he formed after the denunciation of Theosophy is based on the principle that no one should have a teacher, that you should be the only teacher of yourself. And he gained many, many, many pupils this way.
Did he stay in England or what?
No, he spent his time, until his death in the 1980s, he spent his time touring around the world. But most of the year he would spend his time in America, where Annie Besant bought him some land, and this is where Krishnamurti Foundation still exists. Mm-hmm.
I've been living in India for the past year and a half, not entirely, but I was told that there was one reason why he may have rebelled was the fact that he discovered that Blavatsky actually said that she, how do you, you have to use deception to influence people, and I think that that was one of the reasons I was told that he became very disillusioned with that.
So. Yeah, might have been so. Blavatsky did indeed say that. She said that to several people on different occasions when she was criticized of being a fraud. Perhaps she was right in this sense.
If I may come back to the links to Freemasonry here, you were mentioning that Annie Besant was working or was found in Freemasonry. What did she find in Freemasonry that she didn't find in Theosophy?
That's an excellent question, really hard to answer, since Annie Besant and her friends in London were into any kind of activity that would have to do with the esoteric lore. I don't think that she emphasized the original ideas of Freemasonry more than the Theosophical ideas. I think that she just used it as another platform to gain disciples. That's what I think. Her activity also in Freemasonry was more political than ideological. And the fact that that French order, the Order of Commerce, accepted women, I think that was the main point which attracted her. In a way, I think she wanted even to break the authority of the original Freemasonry in England, if you'd ask me.
But she found also this Order of the Star of the East.
Yeah, but that was not a Freemason order. It was an order founded to honor Krishnamurti.
Oh, right, that's
yeah.
the one, that's the Krishnamurti
yes.
order.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Yes. Because the Star of the East has, of course, as already mentioned, an immense symbolic dimension in Freemasonry since the 18th century.
Is this the Star Sirius?
It's not that easy. There are orders that are identified. And in Sweden, for instance, there's a paramasonic order called the Order of Sirius. So that would fit in that respect.
There's another movement which sees Sirius as a special star, which is the Eamon, also born in England. I don't know if you're aware of that.
The
Eamon. Eamon. It's a relatively new movement founded in the 1980s, I think, 1970s.
Eamon.
They are growing up rapidly.
When coming back to Rosicrucianism and Christian Rosenkreuz's story about his initiation in Fez in Morocco, and the question there would be, what would Christian Rosenkreuz find in Morocco and Fez that he wouldn't find in Rome or in Constantinople?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I was trying to refer to it in a way, maybe not in the most deepest way, but I think that Europeans, as in general, had always the tendency of observing the East, in general, as a mystical place. And since Morocco was in the East, the Middle East, in Arab territory, it reflected on that idea naturally. I don't think it would have really mattered if the myth of Rosenkreuz would contain a story about him being initiated in Syria or Lebanon or Palestine or wherever. I don't think it's really important in that sense.
But he's linking into a non-Christian.
Yes, indeed. But so did many other occultists in Europe since the Renaissance time. When you come to think of it, most of the esoteric movements and esoteric new, so to speak, religions were contradictive to Christianity. So I don't think that this this is different in any way. The secret tradition of esotericism, occultism, is believed to have existed before Christianity or before Judaism by these people. So the fact that he was initiated in Morocco doesn't mean he was initiated by Muslim sages, or they were Muslim in religion, but the doctrine that they taught him was not Muslim or Jewish or Christian in that sense. It belonged to the same secret doctrine that is going around in a secretive way alongside the well-known history.
Could they have been Sufis?
Well, they could have been, but I don't think that there's any source that will give you the answer to that. It was just said that he was initiated there, and that's about it.
In this case, we are not talking about a real person.
No, it's a myth as much as we know.
Yes.
There might have been a real person, but name
yes.
Christian Rosenkreuz, but lots of people have tried to locate that person and did not succeed. So I don't think that we'll be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really matter, since so many people believe that he did exist, and so many people were imprisoned in Europe, especially in Paris and also in several German cities during the 17th and 18th centuries. So as in many other cases, the idea is what really counts and not the existence of the real person.
If I may add something, There was a person in Sheffield who was the Grand Baphomet of the OTO,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
he was saying that you have to go to the East to become sort of to have the right credentials. Like Joe Cocker, who was a gas fitter in Sheffield, had to go to America to become famous or to
right.
be acceptable. So it's partly to do with
yeah.
With that.
That's exactly the point I was trying to emphasize. That it gave any magus, any
yes.
magician or anyone with pretensions,
like Alistair Crowley as well. He was
exactly, exactly. Yeah, of course. I think that any major occultist movement or any major presumed magician had to have in his or her CV something that had to do with the East.
Yeah.
Yes. As I've mentioned, if until the 19th century, Morocco or other Middle Eastern locations were sufficient, towards the end of the 19th century, you had to go further on to India, Tibet, China.
Yeah.
the most remote place would be like the best for your credentials. I think it's still so today, in a way.
Yeah.
For many people. Sorry.
What's the connection with the origin of spiritualism by the Fox sisters? Because
there's no connection.
They brought in a kind of
mm-hmm.
new consciousness in a way. I mean, it was very easily got cheapened and so on, but it was a new current, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course.
And that's in the West.
I think it was a totally new current which marked the birth of spiritualism, actually,
yeah.
in 1848, definitely. But this case doesn't have to do with the Orient or,
no.
or with the East, as much as I know.
No,
no,
that's what I'm saying. It's not
right. Sure, but I think that there's a difference between regular, so to speak, spiritualism, and between occultism. It's not the same thing, because spiritualists believe that you may communicate with the souls of the deceased people, with the other world, and this has nothing to do with a belief in a very ancient doctrine that has been going around throughout many centuries and many people. It's a completely different sphere, the sphere of spiritualism. But you are right. There is Western spiritualism. It does exist, and of course, you could always talk about Celtic cults and many other examples.
The Grail, for example.
Of course. But the Grail also has its sources in the East, so to speak, because Jesus Christ was born there. I mean,
yeah. What about Rudolf Steiner, who was an Austrian academic?
I'm actually going to talk about him on Saturday. I don't know if maybe you want to promote your event.
Yes, sure. We will have an event on Saturday with four speakers here at our center called The Temple Legend, Links Between Freemasonry, Theosophy and Anthroposophy.
Mm.
Isaac will be one of our speakers. I will talk, and Nick Thomas, former Secretary General of the Anthroposophical Society
mm.
in Great Britain, will be a speaker, and Helmut Sander, author of a book on anthroposophy in Germany, and also author of many other interesting papers on Freemasonry and anthroposophy. So we will have more time to go.
Did you mention the temple
in the legend, yes.
Oh, with Jerusalem.
The story of the constructing of Solomon's temple. Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes, that is told in a special version within Rudolf Steiner's lectures, and question is, I don't know if it's also told within Blavatsky,
mm-hmm.
This version of the temple legend.
No.
So, which is quite fascinating variety.
Is that on the fact that it wasn't built by human entities and there were no iron tools involved in it?
Yes, to a certain extent, but in Freemasonry, the temple legend is, of course, the Hiramic legend about the murder of the architect of the temple is the key story of the third degree. And in the anthroposophic version, or Steiner's version of it, there are not only you have other actors. For instance, you have a female actor, the Queen of Sheba, Balkis, the Queen of Sheba,
yes, yeah.
And she does not occur at all in the traditional Masonic version of this temple legend. Yes. And we will explore all these aspects.
That's of course the Quranic, that she came and visited Solomon.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
yes. And in the anthroposophical version, this is an integral part of it.
Yes.
Because she enters then into a relationship with Hiram and not with Solomon. After which Solomon is in a way taking part in the plot to kill Hiram, which of course for the Freemason would be
Hiram and
blasphemy.
A problem, a blasphemy,
mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's a very interesting and fascinating
variety. What time is
variety.
That?
It's, we will start on Saturday at 11, our workshop here, in these premises.
But regarding your question about Steiner,
yes.
Which is an excellent point. Steiner was indeed related more to the Western tradition than the Oriental one, and this was the major part of his strife with Annie Besant, and I think was the main reason for his he was actually kicked out of Theosophy, if I may speak bluntly, because he was not satisfied at all with the Krishnamurti cult. He thought that it was ridiculous that a Hindu boy would be the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. So he rather preferred the more European Western tradition of philosophy, rationalism, more than the Oriental tradition, and he was criticizing harshly Blavatsky's and Annie Besant's tendency towards Indian practices such as yoga or other Indian practices, just disliked them. But basically, he was a theosophist. Before he was an anthroposophist, so the things he believed in had to do, in a way, with the things that the theosophists believed in. So he definitely had some Oriental or Eastern principles in what he said.
I was out, so maybe someone asked already. Did Blavatsky have any connections to Sufis? Did you meet them, or was
what your question immediately brings in mind the story of Gurdjieff, which had a very close connection to Sufis, from whom he had learned what he was teaching, but Blavatsky did not have a direct connection with Sufis. She told that she met Sufis
in
many places, in Egypt and also in the Caucasus, where she had traveled as a teenager and as a child with her father. He was stationed in many different bases. And actually, she was telling that she met almost anyone you could think about. But she had really many marvelous stories, which, as I've said, it's really hard to verify all these stories. And I don't think that this is also really the point that matches, because most of the her criticizers were looking exactly to that point. Oh, we found the bluff, okay? She was bluffing. She was not really in that point in the same year that she was referring to. This is not the point. The point is what she was saying, and the wave, the intellectual and spiritualist wave that she was evoking. That's what I think.
Quickly coming back to Steiner, it's very, very interesting that he looks at the structures of doing spiritual work and spiritual development and says an awful lot about that structure within the East, but he's basically not doctrinal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very interesting that for the vehicle of conveying this knowledge and teaching this knowledge, he goes to Western European culture and develops the Arthurian tales as a vehicle to carry his messages,
mm-hmm.
and it's of course continued with Steiner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's very anti-doctrinal, isn't he?
In a way it is, but I think that if you'd ask me, I think any person who creates, who founds a movement who has certain rules about about the initiation process into his movement must have a certain doctrine, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
It's not completely of any doctrine at all. But I think that Steiner was referring also to Blavatsky's doctrine, which she had called the secret doctrine, as the same title as a famous book, and I think that he appreciated the idea very much. I don't think that he was against it. I think that he fully accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
As he said himself, he did appreciate Blavatsky and felt her as a genuine philosopher and a spiritual person. The quarrel he had with her successor, Annie Besant, did not have to do with her, but with the the character of Annie Besant, who was quite a hard woman in many ways.
As I understand it, Steiner accepted Blavatsky, but said she got as far as the moon whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And he claimed he was able to go further to a sun whistle,
mm-hmm.
which was really a discovery of the reality of the incarnation of the Christ,
mm-hmm.
which was lacking in the traditional theosophies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's his claim to be
mm-hmm.
taking it a stage further,
mm-hmm.
But also linking it up with, as you say, Western intellectual
mm-hmm.
thought,
mm-hmm.
particularly Goethe,
mm-hmm.
Right. And medieval mystics, so
mm-hmm.
it's, and Rosicrucianism. So
mm-hmm.
he kind of collects it all together.
Yeah, it does.
You mentioned another interesting figure, Cagliostro, and
mm-hmm.
just to tell you that just a couple of weeks ago, a new book has been published
mm-hmm.
called Masonic Magician, The Life and Death of Count Cagliostro
mm-hmm.
di Balsamo,
mm-hmm.
as he was called. And this book has, within 3 weeks, sold in 10,000 copies.
Wow. Amazing.
So, yes. So,
is it in English?
It's in English, yes. It was published by Bob Cooper from Grand Lodge of Scotland, together with an author, Philippa Fawkes.
Right.
And just that to show that these, you had a nice way of describing Cagliostro, which I want you to repeat from your manuscript, because I didn't have the time to scribble down. You called him a kind of cosmopolitan figure, that, da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
So, my question was, how did you brand this kind of personality like Cagliostro and others?
Mm-hmm.
What is so special with them? There's a cosmopolitan element, but what else?
There's a certain charm that goes with these sort of people. They're being very charismatic. And usually you need to be charismatic if you claim to own supernatural forces. Because just a normal, regular person who would tell you this, you probably just laugh and turn to the other side. And Cagliostro is one of the very small number of people who had actually convinced many others that he did have this kind of power. He was basically, as much as I understand, a healer. In a way, he was of the same generation of Franz Anton Mesmer.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
But Mesmer was pretending to be an actual doctor, physician. Sorry. And Cagliostro just skipped that phase and went directly to the connection to the different planets and astrology and. Deriving his powers from the skies and using the cosmic energy, and he was also, I think, quite good with people. If you refer to characteristics of
yes.
people who managed to become such magnates on the social level. Because he acquainted many, quite a lot of noble people and royalty all over Europe, and was invited to various palaces and parties, and for some time he was a real celebrity,
yeah.
mm-hmm. and he loved it.
And even 300 years after his, or 250 years after his death,
he's still considered an enigmatic character.
Yeah.
Do consorting with angels.
John Dee?
Yeah.
Yeah, in a way, yes. But John Dee was related, as much as I know, more to the Hermetic tradition. Cagliostro was saying that he was also dealing with this kind of Hermetic philosophy, but as much as I know, this was not his real practice. Because John Dee, you could relate him more directly to people like Massilio Ficino in Italy or Giordano Bruno. That would be the right milieu to count John Dee in.
Cagliostro wasn't a secret agent, or did he influence political events at all?
Well, honestly, I don't know. I mean, I never had a real deep research on Cagliostro. I've read about him, and perhaps the book that Andres was referring to.
Yeah,
what is his book?
It's called Masonic the Masonic Magician, The Life and Death of Count Cagliostro.
He was suspected of being a spy, that's for sure, but I don't know if he really was. Because Giordano Bruno, for instance, was a real spy. He was spying in England. He was living in London as an honorable guest at the French embassy court, and he was spying. He was actually spying both for the French king, and both for Elizabeth, the British queen. So he was like a double agent in this sense. There's an excellent book published about 12 years ago by Juan Bossi describing this affair, the embassy affair. Giordano Bruno. Joseph Bossi.
Right. Good. Any more comments or questions? Otherwise, we heard about that these talented people must have a social side as well. And with that, I want to invite you to share a glass of wine with us and sandwiches outside.
We'll try to be charming as we can.
Yes, exactly. And inspiring.
And charismatic.
So, yes, exactly. So please, you're welcome to join us for...